for my generation was something only trains did. Then it became a word to describe the business of finding a partner, an important business for the future of the species. But today, in the developed world and even beyond, the data shows that coupling is significantly down. Increasingly, people are just not forming those relationships. There are all kinds of theories out there about why this is happening, ranging from the intriguing to the improbable. So what do we know about this non-coupling and its implications? And what are the best guesses? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. Joining me to talk about this are Dr. Alice Evans, who's a visiting associate professor at Stanford University and author of the upcoming book, The Great Gender Divergence, and John Byrne Murdoch, columnist and chief data reporter for the Financial Times, who's been doing a lot of work in the area of demographics. Alice Evans, before we get into the question about coupling data, can you just define coupling for us? Is this people getting married, people in long-term relationships? What is it?
I think very simply long-term committed relationships where you might even consider having your child together.
Right. And you can actually measure that. You can actually ask people, is that what you're interested in or doing or not doing? And you can therefore get back reliable data.
Right. So across the world, surveys and questions will vary, but they will typically ask, are you married or are you married or cohabiting?
Right. John, let's take a look at that data from across the world. Lay out some of the most interesting aspects for us or most significant.
Yeah, so I think the most interesting thing here is that we really see this steady and then slightly increasing decline in that measure. So this measure of are you either married or cohabiting. And we see this in many, many, many regions around the world, many very different regions. So in East Asia, the share of people aged 25 to 34, so that sort of adult thinking about kids age, the share of those people who are in couples in East Asia has gone from 64% to 46%. Over the last 25 years, so almost a 20 percentage point drop. Fewer than half now being in those committed relationships. In Latin America, it's similar, fall from 64% to just less than half. Middle East and North Africa, similar fall. And in the West, the same again. So very different places with different cultures, different economic situations all showing this. The exceptions, though, that I think are also interesting are places like South Asia, so India, Pakistan, where relationship rates are much higher and more stable.
So they haven't changed so much there. So we'll get in a little bit into why that may be in a moment. To be parochial for a moment, what about us here?
Us here, yeah, there's been a decline of between 10 and 20 percentage points, depending on exactly which survey you look at, again, over the last 15 or so years. So a really quite marked decline across all sections of society.
John, can I just get a sense of how recent this is or isn't? You've given a relatively long time frame, but the sense that I'm getting from you is that actually a lot of this is quite recent.
Yeah, so there was a steady, very steady decline up until around 2010. And then we see a steeper decline in the 15 or so years since then.
Right. OK. Now, looking, Alice, at the differences between countries, I presume some countries have always had a greater level of, if you like, kind of single person households.
Yes, that's totally true. So, for example, South Africa, I believe around 40% of women under 30 are single mothers, for example. Latin America saw a decline in coupling over the 20th century and also a rise in single mothered households.
What about places where single households have not been as a result of a single parenting, but are simply that adults choose not to live in couples?
Totally. So in Sweden, at least 60% of adults are single adult households. And I think that reflects a broader culture, maybe people being a bit more introvert. But also, as entertainment technology improves, then basically us humans have to tussle in this dynamic trade-off and that we're constantly competing. So, you know, on Friday night, do I want to go out on the town or do I want to watch Bridgerton? Well, maybe I'll be lazy and stay indoors. So as the entertainment technology enables greater personalization, constant whatever you want at any time, any place, you know, rather than us all leafing through the Radio Times or the Sunday Times to find out, oh, yes, there's a film on at 8 p.m., as we used to do maybe 20 years ago. Now there's constant entertainment on demand, whatever you want, whenever you want. And so that can often outcompete the guys next door, so people socialise less.
Right, so these are quite interesting theories about why this is happening. We'll come back to some of them in a moment and link them possibly to other kind of cultural changes which you've hinted at. But John, just going back to the coupling, are there any places that are bucking the trend which might give us some clues?
South Asia, so India, Pakistan, are certainly interesting in terms of having sustained quite high coupling rates there. Japan is interesting in the sense that it went through the latest stage of its demographic transition relatively early. So Japan's birth rate fell to very low levels earlier than many other countries. That's why we've been talking about it as the sort of poster child of falling birth rates for a long time. And that happened not completely independently of the decline of coupling, but in a kind of separate timing. So Japanese coupling rates are still falling today, even though its birth rate is relatively stable. So I would say in many countries, we've seen coupling and birth rates move in tandem, certainly in a lot of the notable ones, whether that's South Korea, we see the US, Finland. But there are some exceptions where those two things have happened at slightly different times.
Let's talk about the aspects of an explanation for this, which most people immediately gravitate to, which are there are economic explanations for this. So, John, let's talk about the one which I hear most at the moment, which is coupling is not happening because people can't afford to move in together because of the housing situation. A very kind of London-centric view.
Yeah, this one's interesting because, again, the picture looks really quite different in different countries. So for people in London, people in the UK, many parts of the US, this is both sort of measurably true and feels very obvious that getting secure long-term housing, which in many Anglophone countries essentially means owning your home, that has become harder to do. And of course, if you can't move out of your parents' home, then you're obviously not thinking about long-term relationships. Everything's a bit cramped. You don't really like the idea of you and your partner creeping around the house while your mum and dad are there as well. So that certainly feels like a plausible explanation for part of what we're seeing in the UK. But then a country like Finland has a very different thing going on, which is where, a bit like Sweden, as Alice was mentioning, you have a high and rising share of young adults living on their own. Now, economically, that wouldn't make sense if the economics would encourage people to couple up, because then two incomes, easy to afford housing. But in Finland, there are actually policies which encourage that. They make it easier for solo young adults to get their own housing. So you can see how the economics and the policies can actually point in opposite directions and still produce that outcome. Now, I think that's interesting and worth remarking upon, but the fact that we see these similar trends in countries that have very different housing and economic situations, again, would at least suggest that a significant part of this trend is driven by the other stuff.
Alice, how do you see this housing stroke cost of living argument as being the main driver? What are the problems with that?
Well, I think, for example, look at Singapore. In Singapore, over 80% of housing is government owned, but it's got very low coupling. So I don't think that the economics can explain. Moreover, as any of us know, that it's much cheaper to have a roommate to live together, right? You save costs on rent if two people are living together. So that can't be a full explanation for me. And especially why coupling is falling at very different levels of economic development across both towns and cities with different house to earnings ratios.
And you have some interesting observations about places like Tamil Nadu. You better remind us, for some of us, exactly where that is and what's interesting about it.
So the reason why India is interesting is because it has this very high rate of arranged marriage, but the total fertility rate in Tamil Nadu is 1.4, which is the same as England and Wales. And yet, only 29% of urban women in Tamil Nadu work. So it's not that women are overworked and they can't manage work and housework or work and babies. Like, they're barely working. So India could be a very unique story due to its fears of overpopulation. Elsewhere in the world, I think the plausible hypothesis for me is at least this cultural shift in women's preferences and men struggling to adapt. I call it cultural leapfrogging. In Mexico, in Morocco, in Turkey, in Malaysia, women are basically leapfrogging to the egalitarian frontier, and they're adopting those ideas, those memes. So, for example, when I track Google Trends in Turkey, I see from 2022, which is when Instagram Reels came out, this big surge in terms like toxic relationships, gaslighting, and even ADHD and lip filler. So all these sorts of Western terms went global.
John.
Yeah, and there's good data on this. So I I've looked at some of the similar Google Trend stuff, and you do see this takeoff of things that we would very much associate with this sort of Western, more individualistic and perhaps progressive movements. And there's been academic work on this as well. So we touched briefly on sub-Saharan Africa. Studies there have shown as well that it's not just people being on social media. It's specifically when young women are on social media at relatively high rates, you'd see a more rapid decline in birth rates, which again, I think is very much consistent with this idea that cultures, values, norms are spreading across borders and across levels of economic development in a way that could be influencing these decisions about coupling and children in a very wide range of contexts.
Okay. Is it simply a matter that right the way across the world, women are finding men insufficient?
I wouldn't put it like that, but rather that women have raised their preferences. Let us say, for the past hundreds and hundreds and thousands of years, every world religion was extremely patriarchal, teaching women to obey, submit, be silent, etc. And now many women across the world are connecting and they're gravitating to the content to say, no, you deserve better. What are your preferences? You know, when I do my interviews in Turkey, I speak to grandmothers who don't even consider their own preferences. And now young women around the world are saying, what about me? What about what I want? And then I think the friction is that many men across the world are not adapting to women's new preferences.
Again, John, this is a fascinating hypothesis. To what extent can we say that it's a more likely hypothesis than others because the data suggests it?
I mean, there are long-running surveys here which do seem to show that in many countries, and you see this most in the sort of lower half of the socioeconomic distribution, as it were. So, you know, if you imagine the most educated, higher income people at the top, less well-educated, lower income people at the bottom. In the bottom half of a lot of societies, what you see is that while values have generally been sort of liberalizing over the decades, in the bottom half of many societies, that liberalization has continued or even picked up among young women, but less so among young men. So you do see this sort of divergence in values, broadly defined.
Can you give me an example so that we can kind of hang out? Just one example of where you might measure that.
So some of this would be in things like the World Values Survey, where they ask about gender norms specifically, like about if jobs are scarce, should they go to men before women? Or would women make good political leaders? That kind of thing. And in some of these countries, again, especially in the bottom half, you see that women are moving along that sort of leftward, as it were, trajectory, while men are moving at a slower rate, at least.
So what you've got is a genuine divergence, but particularly marked in that section of the population.
Yeah, so in countries like the UK and US, certainly among more educated and higher earning people, men and women have very much gone in lockstep there. So one of the things that I find interesting is that in high income Western countries, the average young man today is probably actually, to use some of Alice's sort of terminology, probably a sort of better match, a closer to, you know, providing what young women are asking for than ever. And yet you're still seeing that decline. So the sort of the men are getting better, but maybe young women's expectations are accelerating at an even faster rate than men are able to catch up with.
Alice, one of the things that suddenly occurs to me here is that this also coincides with the rise of things like dating apps. I do sort of wonder whether or not the practice of dating apps and the way in which they work and the way in which people use them gives this kind of notion of unlimited choice to people and unlimited betterment. You can always do better. The next swipe will always be better than the last one.
Certainly, I think dating apps could give people the illusion that there are plenty of fish in the sea. I also think you can think about what is the market for romantic love. So let us suppose a man really wants companionship, or let us suppose a man wants sexual intimacy with women. If there are some apps which allow him to get it very easily and quickly without having to demonstrate devotion, he may say, well, I can continue with that for a while. Why bother providing the supply of romantic devotion? But I don't think dating apps can be a full explanation. So, for example, I was in South Korea 2 years ago, and dating apps there are not very respectable. People would prefer to go through matches, to go through people they know, and yet they have a very, very low coupling rate. So I don't think that the apps, I don't think the problem's with the technology. I think it's with us.
John, let's look at what educational status tells us.
Yeah, so this again is where a lot of these trends, whether we're talking birth rates or coupling, these declines are more pronounced in people with less education and lower incomes. And I think there are many ways of making sense of that. Again, one would come back to maybe the economic and housing argument, which I think we've established doesn't neatly fit the data everywhere, but it does at least feel that it fits this part of the story, which is that if people's ability to feel economically secure and therefore to enter into long-term committed relationships at all, if people's economic security is declining, then you would expect exactly what we see, which is for this to show up more in people with less economic means. Then there is, again, the sort of values and socio-cultural part of this, which is that that's where we do seem to see that divergence. Higher status, higher economic status young men are often going along with some of these liberalizing trends. So there are both the economic and the cultural argument would fit the fact that we see that decline more among those of lower economic status.
Alice, one of the other paradoxes in this is it's a very short period of time since all the talk was about commitment-phobic men and women who were desperate for partners. And what you're talking about is a change that's happened with an extraordinary rapidity. Let's go through how we think that transmission can have happened in such a short period of time, if indeed it has been a short period of time.
So I think, for example, if we look at the US and Europe, there's always been this, ever since the 1960s and 1970s, as part of the countercultural movement, a surge of feminist thought, a surge of women trying to persuade others, trying to raise their status, and then communicating through magazines. But now, social media, entertainment technology just enables everyone to collect on. You know, now you can buy a smartphone in Malaysia for maybe $50, very cheap. You can get cheap online data and then can personalize your content so that you are always surrounded by these memes and you're gravitating to particular content that you enjoy. And then everyone is affirming these same ideas in filter bubbles, etc. And then we can see very rapid cultural change. To give one example of cultural change, I was in Brazil for a month last year and I went to a favela in the outskirts of Sao Paulo. I walked into a school where I was invited by the teachers. And the first thing the teacher in the favela wanted to talk to me about was trans. And I thought that was an astonishing example how an idea that's really been popularized by the American left had suddenly gone global, that he really, really wanted to talk about trans rights, even though in a Brazilian context, at least in the favela, you know, the primary gender issues might be boys falling behind or the very high levels of violence or the everyday fights. But instead, an American idea had been transported globally within, say, you know, 10 or 15 years.
John, in a way, this is paradoxical because you could argue, yes, ideas are contagious, but often they're contagious because they confer some kind of advantage on people. You use these things or you think these things or you choose to think these things because they're doing something for you.
You do often. But I mean, there is actually, there's a theory of developmental idealism by a guy called Arlen Thornton. The theory is essentially that people have often assumed that the same evolution in sort of values and culture that happened in the West was almost a driver of their economic development. And therefore, there has been a sense that, well, they are rich and doing well and succeeding, and they also have these other ideals. So we're going to take the whole grab bag, as it were. We're going to take the ideals and the culture and the values because we assume that that goes along with the prosperity and success. So I think certainly that could be part of what...
Which is a kind of associative thing.
Yeah, exactly. But in addition, I think there's... Often this is maybe just more simple, which is that some of the types of memes, narratives, whatever we want to call it, that are circulating on social media, they're really showcasing people maximizing their own individual freedom and consumption and experience in a way that is just very surface level attractive, I think. There's solid evidence here from a previous wave of technological proliferation. So there have been a few studies that have looked at the impact of particular TV shows and the impact of watching those shows on people's decisions around things like family formation. So Melissa Kearney in the US looked at the show 16 and Pregnant. There's also been research in Brazil looking at when soap operas showcased small families. And people who watched these shows had fewer children. So this idea that the visual media, especially I think with visual media, showing other people's lives, the idea that if we consume that, it affects our own choices, I think, is actually pretty solid.
I think we should just now maybe look at why all this matters and now talk about birth rate levels around the world, John. I mean, I think you have to have been living under a stone not to realise that birth rates have been falling practically everywhere, in some places very fast and some places absurdly fast. Now, what I think your research has shown is that it's actually pretty much falling. We used to think it was an issue of education. The more educated women became, then in that case, they were less likely to want to have so many children and so on. That doesn't seem to be borne out by where these things are happening now.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth distinguishing between levels and direction of travel as well. So it's still true in most countries that the more highly educated someone is, the fewer children they have. A, that used to be a huge gap and it's now a very, very small gap. And B, well, the reason that has changed is that more highly educated people are generally having children at roughly stable rates, maybe slightly falling. But among the lower educated, they're falling very steeply. Same with coupling rates as well. But then internationally, it's the same thing. So we used to think, well, very low birth rates go with very prosperous countries. But there have now been a lot of middle and even lower income countries seeing very rapid declines. So you now have a situation where Mexico has a lower birth rate than the US. And countries like Turkey, Iran, Tunisia have now pretty much the same birth rate as the UK. So this thing that we used to think happened as a result of prosperity and high female employment rates and education, we're now actually seeing in a huge range of contexts. And of course, that matters because rich countries have more resources to deal with the consequences, whereas you're now getting all these middle-income countries, which you could say are getting old before they get rich.
And Alice, you could argue that the problem is not a decline in the rate of population growth, but is actually the fact that you have an ageing population, which is a problem in itself.
Right. So as the workforce contracts, then fewer adult workers need to pay for elderly social care, elderly healthcare, and also pensions. But let me add something very exciting, a new paper that came out yesterday from Daron Acemoglu, the Nobel Prize winner. They look at the fall in fertility across the US. And what they find is actually very interesting. They find that where fertility fell in those commuter belts, there was actually more technological innovation. So it's not just a question of how many laborers you have, but how innovative they are, how productive they are. So the interesting tension is, we in Europe, our problem, though, however, is that we haven't seen that. In Europe, we've just seen pretty much, you know, very slow or stagnant productivity. We haven't seen that productivity rise. So maybe there's something in the US that falling fertility has motivated these productivity improvements, but something in Europe means that maybe we've got over labor supply and firms just, you know, when I was doing my research in Leicester and Luton, you see lots of hand car washes, right? People aren't automating. So maybe there's surplus labor.
Right. Let's now talk about what we could conceivably do about it. We conceive on this programme for the time being that low levels of coupling is a problem. It's a problem that leads to lower fertility, which will exacerbate the problem of an ageing population. We should do something about it. John, I'm going to give you first go at this and then Alice. Let's look at conceivable solutions if we buy some of the hypotheses which we've been talking about.
Yeah, I think, a lot comes down to how we frame this. If this is framed as women aren't having enough kids or women are being too picky, then of course you rapidly go down quite unpleasant ideas and things that would sound quite reactionary and rightly. Whereas I think if we frame this as what we're seeing here, the decline in coupling is going in tandem with a rise in loneliness and isolation, a reduction in the amount of time people are spending socializing at all, and a worsening in many of these same people's mental health, then this feels like we have a more obviously problematic trend, which we should try to remedy. So there, I think we should just be thinking about how do we create the environments where people are going to spend less time glued to their phones and more time hanging out. And certainly there have been anecdotally early reports of the impact of some of the phone bans in schools has been teachers stunned to see these same kids suddenly just playing cards over lunch and that kind of thing. So, and I'm not here saying that bans and regulation are necessarily the answer, but I think we should be thinking about how can we get people hanging out more, interacting more, having fun, and in ways that don't require them to spend huge amounts of money. And, you know, maybe some of this ends up in relationships. Maybe plenty of it doesn't. But this just feels like a positive development that I think few people would argue with.
Alice, that's all very well, but I don't quite see how it's going to make young women think that young men are more desirable.
Right. I think that's a major mismatch. And I think the truth is that cultural engineering is now very difficult. For example, in Sweden, it was only in 1989 that they allowed private media. Before then, it was all state TV, and the state could effectively indoctrinate everyone into egalitarianism, social democracy, etc. But then with private media, you start to see critiques. Now we've destroyed all the capital constraints that anyone can start their own podcast. Anyone can communicate with anyone anywhere. So the act of persuasion, the act of mass persuasion, is very difficult if people don't already agree or gravitate to those same priors, which is our case for the more disadvantaged men who may rather, you know, just play games, hang out, chat by themselves, etc. So there's a real, real struggle of how do you persuade those who aren't already persuaded. Now, one idea might be, let's think about financial incentives. The government could give people an incentive to have children by, you know, a pension incentive. So there could be financial advantages to having children. Whereas at the moment, many would see having children as a risky, uncertain, huge investment that they're just not sure about.
Alice, let's imagine for a moment that I'm a young parent with a young boy and a young girl. What am I telling them in the better world that I'm not telling them now?
Well, I think one great start would be for kids to go out and have fun in the playgrounds, to explore the world, to feel free, to climb trees, to play about and meet new friends. I think the, you know, as LLMs and AI, you know, automate technical tasks, then the one distinctive thing about being human is that we can make jokes and make friends and be sociable. And we should start finessing that skill and be friendly to each other.
John, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, the same advice you would give your kid to make sure they get a job in this AI era is the advice you would give to them about relationships. It is, be someone who is great fun to be around, like socialising, teamwork, that kind of thing. Those skills will, I think, help both economically and socially and in terms of coupling in children.
So, parents, the advice is get your children to be like John and Alice. And that's all we've got time for, I'm afraid. My thanks to Alice Evans and John Byrne Murdoch. And my conclusion, you should get out there and party more. Or if you don't want to do that, you can visit BBC Sounds and find our entire back catalogue of programmes, more than 400 of them, including the one asking whether Europe can build digital sovereignty and the one asking, will Trump invade Cuba? We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter and Kirsty Knight. The production coordinator was Siobhan Reed. The sound engineers were Gareth Jones and Neil Churchill. And the editor was Richard Varden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again very soon.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Paris. That's You're Dead to Me. Listen first on BBC Sounds.